ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
He was the man who stole the plans for the atomic bomb. A brilliant physicist, a devoted communist. A spy hiding inside the most secret project on Earth. This is the story of Klaus Fuchs, a man who believed he could serve two masters, science and the Soviets. To hear it, search for The Bomb on the ABC Listen app.
I'm Christina Kukolya, sitting in for Damien Carrick here on Radio National. And first, a warning. The Law Report is discussing the very essence of life and death, including organ and tissue donation. There are strong details around medical procedures that may trigger or distress some listeners. The Australian Law Reform Commission is conducting a review of the laws that govern how human tissue can be used. It's been almost 50 years since the first Human Tissue Acts were introduced, and in the time since, scientific, medical and technological changes have outpaced the legislation. Dr. Megan Taves is a legal academic specialising in health law at Adelaide University. She's the co-leader of the review and says the starting point is to re-examine what is human tissue.
Under the Human Tissue Acts, tissue is actually defined very broadly. It is defined to include organs or body parts, as well as substances extracted from the body or a part of the body. And so this could include solid organs like heart, liver, lungs, kidneys. It includes blood, bone marrow, bones, muscles, corneas. It really is quite expansive. And one of the issues that we're considering is actually the definition of tissue itself and what should or shouldn't be included. Because what's happened over time is that there are new uses for tissue that weren't really in contemplation at the time the legislation was passed. And so the Human Tissue Acts now are being applied to circumstances where they arguably are not quite the best fit.
What are some examples of this?
So in the Human Tissue Acts, there are generally sections devoted to living donation and sections of the legislation devoted to deceased donation. And in the living donation sections, what we see is a specific exclusion from the definition of tissue of sperm and egg cells and embryos, these kind of reproductive materials. But there's no similar exclusion to the definition of tissue in the deceased context. And so what we see then is the Human Tissue Acts being applied to the retrieval of sperm and egg cells in the deceased context. So in someone who has already passed away, sometimes their surviving spouse or partner might want to retrieve their reproductive material and store that for future assisted reproductive treatments. But one of the problems is it's a completely different framework that applies if you actually want to use those cells. And the two frameworks are not always consistent in terms of consent requirements from the donor of the reproductive material. So under the Human Tissue Acts, essentially what's being done is we're applying the same framework that applies to deceased organ donation to deceased sperm retrieval, for example, which doesn't necessarily require the prior explicit consent of the donor. There's a framework for next of kin to provide that consent. Whereas in the assisted reproductive space, in many of our states and territories, there's legal frameworks that actually require the prior explicit consent of the donor to be able to use that material. And so what's happened is there are cases and situations where we're using Human Tissue Acts to extract the material, but then if you actually want to use that for future reproductive purposes, you then have to go back to apply to the court to actually transfer this material to a jurisdiction that's a bit more permissive, where you can actually use it. And so there's these differences in legal frameworks that potentially need to be harmonized.
Now, human milk, curiously, is also included under the definition of human tissue in some legislation. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a really interesting one because, again, now in modern times, we have human milk banks, which exist to help babies in the NICU who otherwise don't have access. And so what we see is different states and territories interpreting tissue differently, with some treating it more as a tissue and some treating it more as a food. And how you characterize it has different implications in terms of what regulatory framework applies. And so looking at whether it should be characterized as a food, a tissue, or maybe some other type of therapeutic product is something that we are considering.
Now, the definition of tissue may also create problems in research the Commission has identified. How?
One of the provisions in the Human Tissue Acts prohibits the trade in human tissue. And so what we've heard from some people in the research space is that there's a concern about researchers in Australia not being able to access cell lines for their research, because a lot of these cell lines are produced overseas and need to be accessed and sometimes purchased. And so there's a concern that characterizing the cell lines as tissue and having them subject to the prohibition on trade might be hampering research in Australia to the extent that researchers aren't able to access these necessary materials.
Those are just some of the complex legal and ethical questions that the review is examining. The focus, though, is on organ and tissue donation, including, crucially, changes that could help improve Australia's transplant rates. Angela Webster is a professor of epidemiology at Sydney University and a transplant physician at Westmead Hospital. She says the medical definition of death in Australian law is a barrier to increasing the number of organs available for transplant.
Australia at the moment is at odds with most of the rest of the world. In Australia, we have two components of the definition of death. One is a cease in brain activity, and the second component is a cease in circulation. Now, internationally, the definition tends to be a cease in brain activity or a cease in circulation to the brain, and we're missing that part, to the brain. And so at the moment, the way that the Australian law is written, death occurs when the cessation of a circulation, full stop.
Angela Webster says that definition is preventing new procedures that preserve organs for transplant in donors who have died.
One of the biggest advances in transplantation over the last probably 10 or 20 years has been the emergence of perfusion technologies. And perfusion means establishing a circulation in the organ you want to remove and use for transplantation. We've had various iterations, including cold perfusion, where after an organ's removed, we perfuse it with cold, chilled fluid, which keeps it cold and stops the damage. Damage occurs to an organ as soon as death occurs, and the damage is worse to the organ while the organ remains warm and it's while it's not getting oxygen. So for years, we've just chilled the organ and literally put it in an esky. And there's been emergence of some perfusion where we can do it with cold fluid while it's in the esky, to try and minimise that damage while it's transported before it goes into the new recipient. Now, the really exciting, more recent emerging technology is what we've one called normothermic regional perfusion. So this is where, rather than waiting until the organ's been removed to try and establish some kind of circulation for transport, after someone's dead, we can re-establish in part of the body, normally the abdomen, a perfusion which is carrying energy and oxygen to those tissues. So while the person is dead, we can re-establish perfusion, stop damage occurring to those tissues, and monitor and see whether some organs could be possible to be transplanted organs, whereas before we wouldn't have been able to do that and they would not have been able to be donated organs.
So it's about re-establishing limited circulation of blood through just part of the body to preserve an organ for donation. Is that a procedure that can be used for all types of organ transplants?
A normothermic regional perfusion usually occurs where it's been used in other countries. It's particularly valuable for liver transplantation because sometimes the manner of someone's dying will have damaged the liver a little, and you'll see that on blood tests you've done around the time of death. But it's very hard to tell just on a blood test whether that damage is going to be permanent or whether it's recoverable. And by using this normothermic regional perfusion, where we re-establish a circulation just in the abdomen by clamping off circulation to the chest and brain and clamping it off to the lower limbs, and we just establish an artificial circulation in the abdomen so that the liver and other organs have oxygen, have energy, we can see whether given a few hours, that liver can recover, or whether there's signs that it's going to be able to be used as a transplant organ. Whereas before, we wouldn't have been able to do that. We just would have had to forego that, and we wouldn't have used those organs.
So that means potentially more organs being available for transplant.
Absolutely. You know, Australia leads the way in many aspects of transplantation. We have a highly successful, organised national and international programme where we do, in fact, sometimes swap donors with New Zealand as well. And we haven't been able to participate in any of the trials of this new emerging technology because of these constraints of the law and the definition of death in Australia. A lot of the emerging evidence is in Europe and shows that it's very, very promising for livers, but there's been less opportunity to trial this for things like kidneys, kidneys being the most commonly transplanted organ. So it's likely that evidence will emerge of this technology being useful for other organs like kidneys, perhaps even cardiothoracic organs, the heart and the lungs. But at the moment, we're prevented from helping that science emerge.
Am I understanding it correctly? Is the concern that it could be potentially illegal to use this technology here?
That's exactly right. The wording of the law at the moment has led to concerns, particularly because from state to state and territory to territory, we have different application and implementation of the current law. I mean, I don't know, I'm not a lawyer, but I suspect that the intention of the original wording of the law wasn't to create divisions like this across states and territory or to prevent Australia advancing science. But at the moment, the way it's worded, we just need to add to the brain as wording. So irreversible cessation of circulation to the brain. That would be enough to change the whole outlook and landscape of what we're able to do.
So is this the case across all states and territories? Are there differences in what transplant doctors can and can't do across jurisdictions?
An issue from state to state and territory to territory in Australia is the things that we're allowed to do after death has been declared and in the process of organ donation, retrieving the organs from the person. So as we take them to the operating theatre to remove the organs to transport for donation. In some states and territories, the implementation of the current law has prohibited any extra treatments being administered then or any extra drugs. Whereas in other states and territories, we do administer those drugs. And so that creates some differences across Australia, which may impact the success of that organ transplant in the end. And an example of that is as death occurs, particularly for donation after circulatory death, there's often a slowing of the circulation before it stops. And during that time, blood can clot. And if blood clots, it will block off important blood vessels in the organs we want to use for transplantation. And so, for instance, in New South Wales, we can give a drug called heparin, which is basically thins the blood, prevents it from clotting. So we give that just before death occurs so that after circulation stops and the person has died, we can retrieve the organs, flush them out with our perfusing fluid, and there's no clots, there's no blockages in those organs, so they function really well. Whereas in other states and territories, for instance, in Victoria, they're not allowed to give that drug heparin because of the interpretation and the application of the same law is different there. And so that potentially for, you know, organ retrieval in Victoria can mean that the organs we take out of the body are not in as good condition as they could be because we haven't been able to use that drug.
One of the more sensitive areas the review is looking at are the medical tests that are performed in hospital to determine if an organ is viable for transplant in patients who are nearing death. So these tests are performed while the patient is still alive. Is it a matter of how invasive these tests can be? What are the concerns around this?
We have various criteria that are different from organ to organ about what an acceptable donor will be in terms of their age, their condition, the other illnesses they have. And sometimes people can have hidden cardiac disease. We call it occult cardiac disease. And so sometimes it may be that in order to understand whether it's going to be a suitable heart for transplant, the non-invasive testing that we do with ultrasounds and echocardiograms may not be enough. And we may want to do something like an angiogram, which is where we would advance a cannula into the heart arteries and inject dye such that we can see on an x-ray how well the heart circulation is organized and whether there's any blockages, which would naturally occur with age, but are difficult to predict. So some of those more invasive tests, for example, at the moment, we don't regularly do in someone that's dead or dying because of the sense of the invasiveness of that. And it's not in, while they're alive, it's not in their best interest to have this test. And so there's a tension between maintaining autonomy and a patient focus on the donor, particularly when death is inevitable or perhaps brain death testing has already started to be occurred, is what you're then doing to the body or doing to that person while they're still at the point of death but not yet declared dead is not in their best interest. And so that's the tension that we have to work with.
You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National with Christina Kukolja. Almost 5 decades after the first legislation was introduced in Australia, the Law Reform Commission is conducting a broad review of human tissue laws. While it's illegal to buy or sell human tissue and organs, the review is also examining whether public calls or advertisements for organ donation, including in mainstream or social media, should be banned. But when it comes to blood, it's looking at whether incentives should be allowed for plasma donation amid a shortage of domestic supply. Dominique Martin is a professor of health ethics and professionalism at Deakin University and a member of the Law Reform Commission's Review Advisory Committee.
There are a lot of serious ethical concerns about offering financial incentives for donation, whether it's of plasma, whole blood, organs, or other types of organs and tissues. We know that two-thirds or more of the global plasma industry is actually supplied by the United States market, where they do provide payments to donors. And my understanding of why that has been successful and then why people might in turn think, well, surely we should offer incentives and then we'd have a better supply of plasma products, it's actually an economies of scale situation. So if you are supplying the global plasma market as the US does, they therefore then are driven to recruit more donors so that they can maintain that supply. That also then makes it less cost effective for countries like Australia to build up their own plasma donor population and to produce some products that perhaps we have a limited demand for. Whereas if we collaborated with other countries, perhaps encourage plasma donation without financial incentives, but were able then to generate the creation of the necessary products for smaller markets, but sort of shared markets, we might be able to meet that demand, I think, more effectively than relying on paid donors. What's interesting about the US market is that we really don't know much about the impact of those financial incentives. There's been next to no social sciences research evaluating, you know, who are the donors, what's the impact on them. But we know from occasional really outstanding journalism reports that have investigated the plasma industry that there is cause for concern that the clinical conditions in which people donate, sort of the care for donors, the desperation of a lot of those paid donors, the impact on their lives, their communities, is really quite concerning. And I think not something that Australia would want to embrace.
Would payment constitute trade in human organs or trade in human tissue, rather?
I think absolutely. At a very simplistic level, but if someone winds up financially better off, at least temporarily, as a consequence of their decision to donate, to provide a body part, then they have effectively sold that body part. Likewise, if someone loses money by obtaining it, then potentially they've engaged in trade. So any form of financial incentive, whether it's a sort of an education scholarship or it's providing people with health insurance, they might all be things that sound really good, potentially beneficial, but if they've got a monetary value and that person wouldn't otherwise have been able to obtain those goods unless they surrendered a body part, then they're effectively selling, in my view.
Which brings us to growing concerns and an issue that's also being examined by the Law Reform Commission review, something that's known as transplant tourism. That's where people travel to another country to undergo an organ transplant and pay for the organ they receive. How is that practice distinguished from legitimate travel overseas by someone to undergo organ transplants?
So the Declaration of Istanbul distinguishes transplant tourism from legitimate or ethical travel for transplantation by saying that it's travel for transplantation where there is organ trafficking and or where by travelling for transplantation, the individual is undermining the ability of the country that you're travelling to meet the needs of its own patients for transplantation. But usually when we talk about transplant tourism, we're focusing on travel that involves trafficking in organs.
And what's known about how many Australians take part in transplant tourism?
We don't have very good data at the moment, and that's not just a problem for Australia, but internationally. I can estimate, I think, with reasonable certainty that there are sort of more than 4,000 people travel every year for organ transplantation in another country around the world. What proportion of those cases involve trafficking is much less certain. In Australia, estimates sort of range from 3 to maybe 20 people travelling overseas for transplant every year. And again, how many of them involve trafficking is uncertain. Some of those cases will be legitimate travel. Maybe someone has a relative in another country who's going to donate their organ to them, or maybe they're travelling to donate their organ to a relative in another country. But in some cases, there are individuals who are travelling to obtain a trafficked organ. So we have generally excellent transplant registries in Australia, in particular the kidney transplants and dialysis patients. So clinicians will sometimes collect data that indicate that a patient is no longer receiving dialysis because they've received a transplant overseas. But that registry, for example, usually wouldn't include information about a patient who has preemptively travelled for transplant and wasn't previously on dialysis. I receive anecdotal reports from clinicians, so I estimate the number of cases I've been told about each year where someone has travelled. And I've recently been involved in some research with Dr. Georgie Irish from the University of Adelaide and international colleagues estimating international travel for transplantation. And we certainly have seen Australian data coming through there that we will be looking forward to reporting later this year.
From your research, from what's known about Australians who are believed to be travelling overseas for transplant tourism, where do they travel to and for what kind of procedures?
Typically, Australians would be going for kidney or liver transplants, and that reflects sort of the majority of transplant travel in general. Preliminary data from our study shows that about 60% of international travel for transplantation involves kidneys. I think about 20% involves liver transplants. And typically probably are going to destinations, if it involves trafficking, it might be places like Egypt or Pakistan, it could be India, it could be Turkey. And of course, people might legitimately be travelling to the likes of India or Turkey for transplantation as well. But some of those cases will involve trafficking.
Is this something that can be regulated within Australia by Australia, given that it occurs overseas?
I think we can and should consider extending jurisdiction for what are crimes within Australia in terms of trade. We could have extraterritorial jurisdiction over those crimes, such that if someone purchases an organ in the Philippines, then they would be liable for prosecution back here in the same way that they are if they try to purchase a kidney within Australia. Will that actually be effective in stopping travel? Probably not. I think it's maybe a helpful deterrent, but international experience with countries where they do have extraterritoriality for those laws indicate that people will still travel and it can be very hard to prosecute those cases. But I do think there are opportunities with this review of the laws to actually introduce some components that might be helpful in terms of collecting data about transplant travel that then could be used to inform more practical strategies such as educating, deterring, and also responding to cases that might then be able to break up organ trafficking rings and whatnot in collaboration with law enforcement in other countries. The UK, I think, is a really inspirational example. They had an attempted trafficking case within the UK a couple of years ago, and they have very speedily developed some regulations around the reporting of travel for transplantation, which are now in force. They have mandated the reporting of all cases where a clinician suspects that the patient has engaged in organ trafficking, but also mandated reporting of all patients who have travelled for transplantation, regardless of whether there is a concern about trafficking. So it means it's less stigmatizing. It means it's clearer for clinicians. If you're uncertain or you've got any doubt, it doesn't matter. And also, I think it's important to get that data about patients who are traveling legitimately as well.
While navigating overseas jurisdictions is tricky, Commissioner Megan Tave says aligning the various legislation across jurisdictions will have its own challenges.
Jurisdictionally, this is a state and territory issue. And so one of the concerns, I think, in terms of achieving that harmonization is the potential for kind of a staggered approach to implementing different reforms. And so we're trying to take kind of a big picture perspective and look at other areas where there has been considerable harmony, particularly in the health space, such as the national law that established APRA and the regulation of health practitioners, where we see a model kind of legislation being adopted in one jurisdiction, in jurisdictions across Australia, similarly adopting that same law. So that's one potential model that we're looking at in terms of how to try and achieve harmonization and how to achieve harmonization ideally at the same time.
Dominique Martin says law reform will require a broad commitment at all levels of government.
Probably less of an ethical challenge in reforming the laws and more a practical one. How do we get clarity and harmonisation of those laws across so many jurisdictions? And then how do we get governmental support to implement perhaps recommended reforms in every jurisdiction? I think that's going to be the tricky bit and will require a lot of collaborative work, which historically hasn't been the case, and it hasn't been how we've approached sort of individual reforms or amendments to those acts in individual states in the past.
Is the line clearly defined, though? To what extent should the law and policymaking get involved in determining some of the issues that will come before or that have come before the Law Reform Commission? And is there consensus on this within the medical profession and between the medical profession, governments and policymakers? Is everyone on the same page?
I think that's perhaps more of a question for the Law Reform Commission itself. And speaking not as a legal scholar, but as an ethicist, I think it can be difficult sometimes to work out what ought to be in legislation and what would be better placed within, say, clinical guidelines or policy. I think certainly there are elements of current human tissue laws that perhaps would be better placed in the clinical regulatory environment rather than legislation, and perhaps some things that ought to go in to the laws. And whether we get agreement on that, I think, will really depend on which issues we're talking about and how much we are trapped in the history of those human tissue acts. If we're used to having particular pieces of information and requirements in the law, I think people tend to think, well, that's where they belong and we'll keep working with them there, rather than thinking, is this really where it fits? So I think the temptation, perhaps, and looking at the set of issues that have been put forward at the moment, the temptation is to think, what could we add in to those laws? But once you unpack them, there's already a huge amount going on. And I personally think that we should be wary of introducing things into the laws unless we really see the legal framework as being the best way to actually support change in practice, which is what impacts Australians.
The Law Reform Commission says the review should support efforts to increase donations as Australia faces a shortage in organs and tissue available for transplant. The most recent data shows that around 1,800 people in Australia are on waiting lists for transplants. According to the Federal Health Department, donor consent rates have been dropping in recent years. Commissioner Megan Taves acknowledges the ethical issues involved in trying to reverse the trend.
What's really, really important at all times is that we maintain respect for people and respect for people's bodies, even after the point of death. We need to do what we can to try and increase access to organs for transplantation, for tissue for research, for bodies for medical education and dissection. But that increased access doesn't come at all costs, and that always has to be balanced against the need for respect for individuals, for the human body.
That was Australian Law Reform Commissioner Dr. Megan Taves, who's co-leading the review of human tissue laws. You also heard Professors Dominique Martin from Deakin University and Sydney University's Angela Webster. The Commission is expected to deliver its report to the Federal Attorney General in the middle of this year. There's a link to the discussion paper and other useful information on the Law Report website. You can follow the program on the ABC Listen app. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. A big thank you to producer Anita Barrow and sound engineer Tim James. I'm Christina Kukola. Damien Carrick will be back again with you next time with the first new episode for 2026.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.